the sons of the organization's leader. Sheikh Ibrahim Zakzaki were killed along with many of his followers. Then a year later, members of the organization were attacked again, killing at least 1,000 of them, with many others being arrested during the Zaidiyah massacre. Sheikh Zakzaki and his wife were wounded and arrested, then and still remain illegally incarcerated. The question is why? Stay with us as we take a look at this on the Spotlight.
On July 25, 2014, Nigerian soldiers attacked in an international Quds Day rally in the northern city of Zaria by opening fire at people holding a peaceful demonstration. At least 32 people were killed in the attack and many more were injured. The rally was organized by the Islamic Movement in Nigeria, led by the prominent scholar Sheikh Ibrahim Zakzaki. Sheikh Zakzaki has been an outspoken critic of the Nigerian government and its relations with Israel. He lost three of his sons following the attack. One was shot during the rally, and the other two were arrested and later killed by the army along with other detainees. The day following the attack, three truckloads of soldiers went to the Husseiniyah Baqiyatullah, the headquarters of the Islamic Movement, and carried out yet another assault. Nigerian soldiers raided the place and bombed the mosque. Three people were killed and dozens of others were wounded. Sheikh Zakzaki asked people to remain calm and called on the government to investigate the incident and bring those responsible to justice. But instead, another bloodbath took place. In December 2015, Nigerian soldiers attacked a religious ceremony organized by the IMN. The army claimed that they had responded to an attempt to assassinate Nigerian Chief of Army staff. The movement roundly denied such allegations. One day later, the army, using machine guns and tanks, attacked the movement's headquarters as well as the homes of members of the IMN. The extrajudicial killing left over 1,000 people dead.
They inhumanely massacred over 1,000 innocent people, among them 297 women, 23 of them pregnant.
Sheikh Zakzaki and his wife were shot and injured during the crackdown. They were taken into a custody instead of a hospital. Nigerian authorities claimed that they had detained a cleric to protect him from violence. The government later outlawed the Islamic movement in Nigeria. Many members of the IMN believe that all these attacks against their movement have been pre-planned.
Past 20 years, these people have been planning more attacks on the Islamic movement.
Since the attack, Sheikh Zakzaki has been in jail without any charge or trial. The imprisonment is despite a court ruling in 2016 ordering his release. Members of his family said that Sheikh Zakzaki's health condition continues to deteriorate in detention.
Their health continues to deteriorate as they were terribly injured during the massacre. And that has also continuously to be neglected by the government, which has led to the Sheikh having multiple strokes, and Malama could barely walk due to her ailing conditions.
Several human rights groups have expressed concern about Zakzaki's health situation and have called on the international community to intervene. They say the continued detention of the cleric and his wife without any charge violates all acceptable human rights standards. Even though there have been massive protests across Nigeria and the world calling for the release of Sheikh Zakzaki, the religious leader is still in detention. His followers, however, are not standing idly by and have vowed to continue pressing their demand for justice and the release of their leader.
I'd like to welcome my guests to the program, Masoud Shajere from Islamic Human Rights Commission out of Tehran, and Soheila Ibrahim Zakzaki, daughter of Sheikh Zakzaki out of Mashhad. Thank you both for being with me. I appreciate it. I'm going to start it off with Soheila, and I really appreciate you coming on the program. Can we start off, Soheila, and just give us an update as to what's going on, how your parents are doing, and the current legal situation that they're facing?
Thank you very much for having me. Well, the general situation with my parents at the moment is that they have been in detention over the past almost six years now, and they have been moved recently to a general prison, and they have been there for about nearly 2 years now. And their health continues to deteriorate, generally because they have some health concerns without the attack, but also because they were injured during the attack in 2015. As for the court issue, So basically, when they were kept in detention from 2015 towards in December, after the case was taken to the court and Federal High Court in Nigeria decided to rule that the case was their detention was illegal and that they should be released unconditionally, the government decided not to follow that. And after about over a year from that ruling, they decided to, you know, charge them with certain things in a different court. Now, if one were to read the charges that they were charged with in this, you know, current court thing that is going on, it's quite silly, actually. They're charged with apparently culpable murder, and apparently they instigated hundreds of people to go and kill one person. So, yeah, that's what they are saying. And even though they did claim all that stuff, when the court sessions were happening, they didn't bring anything substantial to the case. And so a no-case submission was filed, and now we're waiting on what the judge will do on that by the 28th of this month. Hopefully, we'll get a favorable ruling in that regard.
We're all very hopeful. Masoud, let's look at the overall situation. I mean, do you think there has been added sensitivity towards the Islamic movement in Nigeria due to their massive presence on Quds Day and condemning the Israeli regime? Because I want to go back to this day, July 25th, of course, 7 years ago, which was International Quds Day. Is there added sensitivity because of the group's support for the Palestinian effort, you think?
Absolutely. And, you know, not just Palestinians, but also the Saudis have been actively involved, because the Sheikh has been supporting Yemenis and indeed Palestinians and everyone else who's been oppressed. Islamic movement have been very vocal against injustice, both internal in Nigeria and external. He's been critical of corruption. He's been critical of injustices that are taking place. And that has made him extremely unpopular with the government, but extremely popular with people. You know, Islamic movement enjoys something in the region of 20 million supporters and something in the region of 20 million active members and 5 million supporters. And during the last 5-6 years, that support had increased. There are people saying that the only one who really cares for the people in Nigeria, who's honest, and he calls us as it is, the situation in Nigeria, is Sheikh Zakzaki. And this is not just members of movement, and this is not indeed just Muslims. Christians are actually seeing him as a figure which is hope for the future of Nigeria.
Okay,
and
well, let me get Sohaila. I want Sohaila to talk a little bit about the overall makeup of the Islamic movement of Nigeria, because we know that authorities have been trying to tarnish the image of the group, saying that the group is violent, dangerous. Your take on, and tell me the makeup of the group and the philosophy behind the group, according to what your father had led the group.
Yeah. So, well, the Islamic movement itself did start about 40 years ago, and the general set of ideas that drive the Islamic movement is primarily, you know, basically opposing all oppression and also trying to bring forth a system that isn't, you know, remnants of what basically we have a system in Nigeria that doesn't work. That doesn't work because since colonialism, and also currently we have a lot of corruption. And from the beginning of the Islamic movement, the Pantura Declaration, which my dad delivered a speech that is titled that, which basically is the general ideology of the movement, is that we, as Muslims in that regard, since it is an Islamic movement, need to actually turn to Islam for, you know, how to go about our lives. And ultimately, with the country at large, we have to have a system that is not against our way of life, right? So that's the general idea of the Islamic movement. And Since the start of the Islamic movement, the activities that have been carried out have been for the betterment of generally people there, and that is why there is such large amount of support. You know, if you look at the makeup of the people in the Islamic movement, you'll find all kinds of groups of people. You'll find, you know, academics, you'll find, you know, students, you'll find all kinds of workers, you'll find just the most every kind of group of people you can think of in the society. You'll find them as a part of that, and you'll find the activities being much centered around the development of what we have, the situation we have, trying to better that, right? Trying to enlighten people, trying to educate people on their rights, on, you know, how we are being, you know, oppressed generally in so many ways, and how, what is the solution for that? That's the general activities of the Islamic movement. That's what they entail. And so all of the ideas that, all of the stuff that the government keeps spreading about the Islamic movement being violent or being terrorist, it's unfounded because, I mean, at the very least, you'd think that they would have something to base their, you know, claims on, but there's nothing like that. There's only, if you went across the street, like everywhere in Nigeria, and speak with people who are familiar with the Islamic movement, you wouldn't hear such things. So that's about it, I think.
Okay. Well, in general, Masoud, why do you think the Sheikh is still in prison? I mean, we know that his release was ordered back in from one of the courts back in 2016. What is the overall goal?
Well, the court that ordered his release against the accusation, which is actually almost exactly the same accusation that he's being held now, was the highest court in land. And then afterwards, the government was in contempt of court. They didn't appeal the decision. As a matter of fact, the court said that his arrest is unconstitutional, and he asked the government to pay penalties to him and his wife and provide the accommodation since they destroyed his house. And the government ended up being in contempt of court, and then a lower court charges the same sort of accusation. It is unbelievable. And, you know, this accusation that he has encouraged others to murder, and there were around 200 and odd people sort of charged for acting and murdering. Every single one of them was found not guilty. No evidence was presented against them. And indeed, the courts that we have been going through, this kangaroo court, which has to come to a decision on 28, has failed to bring any witnesses forward to actually prove that Sheikh Zakzaki has done anything wrong whatsoever. And this is why we feel that now that the sort of whole episode of court hearing after court hearing, delay after delay, now the judge has to make a decision. And, you know, you're referring
why do you
to...
Why do you think he has to make a decision this time around? Why do you think he won't delay it again?
Because the prosecution has exhausted all their sort of witnesses, and they haven't proven anything whatsoever. And the lawyers for the Sheikh and the Muallima are now saying that this matter needs to be thrown out of the court, rightly so, because nothing has been proven. If nothing has been proven now, if nothing was proven in 2016, as a matter of fact, the only thing was proven that he was not guilty. So really, the judge has got no option but to pass this verdict. And if he doesn't, it shows that this is really just totally a kangaroo court, and they are just trying to delay after delay when everyone knows what's going on, and indeed was proven in the court.
Well, Sahela, what about the other side of the coin? Has anyone been charged or held responsible for the killing of Islamic Movement of Nigeria members? We know both in 2016 and 2017 that they were attacked and continue to be attacked when they've been protesting. So has anyone, any of these military personnel been charged or are serving time for these crimes?
I mean, you would think so, but unfortunately not. Even the case in 2014, which is 7 years today, there's no one that has been charged or is being punished for what was done, even though at the time the government said they would look into the case and figure out what happened and punish whoever's responsible. And of course, in this case, they're not even addressing that. Not only did they ignore it, did they ignore the crime of the military, they went ahead and declared the Islamic movement a terrorist group. And so therefore, I guess, you know, consider us no longer people who have any form of rights. So yeah, that's unfortunate that nobody is being held accountable for that to this day.
What about that, Masoud? I mean, you're from the Islamic Human Rights Commission. How are they able to get away with that, committing murder in mass, and not holding anyone responsible?
Mazia is astonishing. I mean, I went to Nigeria a few days after, 7 years ago, after the massacre of Al-Quds Day. And what happened, you know, I did an investigation. What happened was the demonstration was actually finished. And the tail of the demonstration was attacked at the last minutes by the military, who arrived from another part of the Nigeria, I believe Abuja, and arrived late and attacked the demonstrators and killed people, massacred them. And, you know, even bystanders, you know, there was a Christian person who actually hid in the shop trying to protect herself, and she was shot through the shutters and so forth. And you know, a beggar was killed. It was really a, you know, massacre. And, you know, the children of Sheikh Zak Zaki, the three who were murdered, and the Ali, which was injured, these were arrested, and then they were shot you know, they just put the gun to their legs and shot them, shattered their bone, and put them, dropped them in a van and take him down there. It was really, it was very, very clear. And evidence and witnesses, which I interviewed and I put it on record, really was very clearly this was a murder, massacre, and using power by the military. And you know, when you go down to the sort of 2015, when that happened, some media went to Sheikh and they said, they killed three of your children. What are you going to do? Are you going to take arms? And Sheikh turned around, famously said, no, truth is the weapon we're going to use to fight, and the due process. And, you know, this is a man who had, you know, who has millions of supporters, and he didn't want to take the law in his own hand.
Okay, stay with me, Masoud. Stay with me. Sorry, let me get Sohaila in on this. Sohaila, what Masoud just said, that the about truth will basically show itself, and I want to look at that, because with that being said, and him promoting actually the opposite of what the claims are against him, that he's violent. With the opposite of that being true, did you expect more from international humanitarian organizations or human rights organizations to get involved and to condemn what is happening and the continued imprisonment of your parents?
Well, yeah, of course we did. We still do hope that, you know, more people would actually speak about it. And it's really, it's crazy that there's not as much people speaking about it, because it's not really the most normal thing that you hear about a military in a country go and kill their own citizens, and then not just once, do it, you know, many times over, and not enough people are speaking about it, and not enough people are paying attention to it, even though there are issues that are much smaller in comparison in terms of how atrocious they are, that are being addressed all the time by a lot of international bodies and things like that. So it's definitely very disappointing. And we did hope initially, but you know, at this point, we kind of still hope that more people would do so. But I believe that, you know, whoever was going to speak about it have already done so. And It's kind of really unfortunate that not enough people did pay attention to the issue.
Well, what about that mass? Why do you think that that is the case? I mean, we have so many international human rights organizations that are continually condemning various governments or entities for oppression, for limiting human rights, being against democracy. Why aren't we hearing a whole lot, if anything, from these organizations?
Really, there's only one way to explain this, and this is the level of demonization of Muslims and Islam and Islamophobia and environment of hate that exists, which actually manifests itself in this sort of way. I mean, look, let's be very clear. The investigation of the government itself on itself, you know, it came out with the fact that that there were mass graves, that they not just murdered people, they actually dumped them in mass graves. Even up to this day, many parents, many people, many loved ones, they're still waiting to get a closure on what happened to their loved ones. And nothing has been done. They admitted that there is mass grave. We know where the location of every single of those mass graves. In the report that we sent to international court, we highlighted all these and the name of everyone who's been massacred. And, you know, they have opened the file, still the investigation going on. But despite all that, international human rights organizations like Amnesty and so forth only echoing what already the Nigerians accepted, which is over 350 to 400 people killed. And they don't go beyond that. They don't even go beyond the fact that they admitted that there are mass graves. What should happen to this? Why the International Human Rights Organization, why the UN, why the EU, why the international community is not asking, where are these mass graves? Let's bring a closure at least on these things. Why do we have to have a situation that someone goes through the highest court in the land, find not guilty, and then taken to another lower court? I mean, this is not just abuse of power in Nigeria. This is abuse of the principles of justice.
Master, what has to happen? What has to happen, you think, right now? What needs to happen in order to see the sheikh and his wife being released? 30 seconds.
Well, I think if they don't release, if the judge doesn't do the right thing on 28, then really there is no hope whatsoever this matter would be resolved within the Nigerian so-called due process. So we actually have to put tremendous pressure from outside. And I think what is really concerned for myself and other campaigners is the health of Sheikh Zakzaki and his wife, and the condition of the prison, and the fact that we are going through a corona crisis, and the fact that they need immediate medical attention. I think first of all, we need to release them, give them the medical attention, and then we need to look at what went wrong, for not just for the sake of those who were killed and shaheed, and those who are injured and their lives destroyed, but for the future of Nigeria, because
okay,
this sort of abuse should not be sort of not addressed.
And on that note, I would love to talk to both of you a lot more. And of course, we'll be following up. You said the 28th is the court, and of course, we'll be continually following that here at Press TV. Thank you both for being with me on this, the anniversary of the Quds tragedy. Masoud Shajere is from the Islamic Human Rights Commission out of Tehran. Soheila Ibrahim Zakzaki, daughter of Sheikh Zakzaki, out of Mashhad. And as always, we appreciate you being with us on another Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashimi. Thanks so much for being with us.
insights into the Holy Quran.
Indeed, this Quran guides to what is most upright and gives the good news to the faithful who do righteous deeds, that there is a great reward for them.
In the name of Allah, the Compassionate, the Merciful, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Assalamu Alaikum. Welcome to another edition of the program, Insights into the Holy Quran, by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hawza Seminary of Qom. Please stay with us.
A'udhu billahi minash shaytanir rajim. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Hello everyone, dear brothers and sisters. I am Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, and we're with you with another edition of the program Insights into the Holy Quran. In this edition of the program, we'll be discussing the commentary of the 23rd chapter of the Holy Quran, Suratul Mu'minun, or the Believers. Now let's just listen to the related verses and then we'll be back. So stay with us.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim.
In the name of Allah, the entirely merciful, the especially merciful.
Innal ladina hum min khashyati rabbihim.
Indeed, they who are apprehensive from fear of their Lord, and they who believe in the signs of their Lord, and they who do not associate anything with their Lord.
Brothers and sisters, we were done with the 56th verse of the chapter, and now we're going to talk about three more verses.
إِنَّ الَّذِينَ هُمْ مِنْ خَشْيَةِ رَبِّهِمْ مُشْفِقُونَ وَالَّذِينَ هُمْ بِآيَاتِ رَبِّهِمْ يُؤْمِنُونَ وَالَّذِينَ هُمْ بِرَبِّهِمْ لَا يُشْرِكُونَ.
These are 57th to 59th verses of the chapter. The first verse says,
إِنَّ الَّذِينَ هُمْ مِنْ خَشْيَةِ رَبِّهِمْ مُشْفِقُونَ.
Verily, those who fear of their Lord, and they are cautious.
وَالَّذِينَ هُمْ بِآيَاتِ رَبِّهِمْ يُؤْمِنُونَ.
And those who believe in the signs of their Lord.
وَالَّذِينَ هُمْ بِرَبِّهِمْ لَا يُشْرِكُونَ.
And those who do not associate aught with their Lord. So, after negating the conjectures of those who are mostly self-conceited and ignorant, the Holy Quran turns to the state of the believers and those who compete in doing good, and then it describes their main characteristics. At first, it talks about them being fearful of their Lord. Verily, those who from fear of their Lord are cautious.
وَالَّذِينَ هُمْ مِنْ خَشْيَةِ رَبِّهِمْ مُشْفِقُونَ.
It is noteworthy that the Quranic word khashya does not mean just any kind of fear, but the kind of fear that is associated with kindness and respect. And in view of the fact that khashya is related to the heart, whereas ishfaq is related to action, the reason why this type of cause and effect is mentioned in the verse will be made clear. The very verse, in fact, implies that the believers are those in whose hearts the fear based upon Almighty Allah's grandeur is found, and its effects become manifested in their all deeds and in their observance of the divine commands. In other words, the area where khashya is completed and perfect is in the realm of ishfaq, and where khashya influences behavior and disposes human beings to fulfill their religious duties and refrain from sin. This is the true meaning of khashya. Khashya, which is by ishfaq, and it is completed and perfected in that.
We hope and pray that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala blesses us with the ability to cover more of His divine
in this
word.
Series of programs, we will inshallah discuss the Holy Quran with a thematic
approach. We will inshallah discuss the chapter
وتمثل القرآن في أخلاقه وفعاله فيه الفؤاد تعلقا وتلاه في جنح الدجى متدبرا.
The context in which Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala speaks in this verse is the context of mentioning the ills and problems and evils of the people of the book, the previous nations who have received revelation, and more particularly the Jew.
Now let's listen to some of the verses of the Holy Quran.
First, let's listen to a few verses.
Now let's listen to some verses of the Holy Quran.
Insights into the Holy Quran by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hawza Seminary of Qom.
The next verse says, وَالَّذِينَ هُمْ بِآيَاتِ رَبِّهِمْ يُؤْمِنُونَ, and those who believe in the signs of their Lord. That is to say, to have faith in the verses of Almighty Allah, which is to believe in the Holy Quran. All of the Quran is the word of Allah, from Ba of the Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim to the scene of An-Nas, the last surah, and they all have been totally sent to the Messenger of Allah sallallahu alaihi wasallam, and all of its commandments must be obeyed. This is true meaning of believing in the Holy Quran, in the verses of the Holy Quran. بِآيَاتِ رَبِّهِمْ, in signs of their Lord. So you cannot be from the type of the people that are نُؤْمِنُ بِبَعْضُ وَنَكْفُرُ بِبَعْضُ. You cannot be believing in some and rejecting the others. And the third verse indicates that the true believers affirm the sublimity and transcendence of Almighty Allah above any other kind of similarity or association. وَالَّذِينَ هُمْ بِرَبِّهِمْ لَا يُشْرِكُونَ, and those who do not associate aught with their Lord. It means that they are pure monotheists. In fact, the negation of polytheism is a result and effect of believing in the signs of Allah. In other words, dear listeners, having faith in the signs of Almighty Allah refers to the divine positive characteristics, and the negation of polytheism refers to His negative characteristics. Polytheism in this verse refers to any kind of polytheism, whether hidden or open. And one last point regarding this group of verse. The 58th verse says, وَالَّذِينَ هُمْ بِآيَاتِ رَبِّهِمْ يُؤْمِنُونَ, and those who believe in the signs of their Lord. And the next one says, وَالَّذِينَ هُمْ بِرَبِّهِمْ لَا يُشْرِكُونَ, who do not associate with their Lord. These two verbs in these two verses are used in present tense, which means a continuity. So, believing in everything that the Almighty Allah sends down, and also being away and not associating anything with Almighty Allah is our permanent duty, and we should observe these forever. Thank you, dear listeners, for staying with us in this program. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
don't be saddened by what you see, by all the lies and treachery. Life is cruel, but don't worry. In your heart lies the key to unwind all the secrets. This life we see.
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English, for listening to us. If you have any question regarding our programs, feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Also, visit our website at parsetoday.com. Until the next program, take care.
Things always worked for me. Why? And that's when faith begins.
If you're interested to know about history, culture, family, politics, religion, art, etc., you wouldn't want to miss the chance to tune into the IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
More victims of a malicious Pegasus software hacking scandal have been revealed, as phone numbers of several prominent British Muslim activists have appeared in a leaked list of successful hacks by the Israeli-made spyware. The list includes Raghad Al-Tikriti of the Muslim Association of Britain, Mohammed Kosbar of Finsbury Park Mosque, Baroness Paula Odin, and Anas Al-Tikriti of the Cordoba Foundation. Mr. Al-Tikriti suspects he was hacked by agents from the Emirates over his past criticism of the regime.
I've had a long-standing struggle with the UAE, and simply because over 10 years ago, I highlighted the fact that the UAE had persecuted and followed on by a prosecution of dozens of reformists, of people who called for democracy, who called for accountability, who called for transparency in their own country. It's a scandal. It's a complete scandal, just like all the scandals that engulf us, unfortunately, on every single level. Infringing on someone's entire life. I mean, this Pegasus software, apparently, I'm no technician, but I understand that I'm being told by experts that it basically takes control of your mobile phone, which essentially is, and this is, you know, something that humanity needs to contend with, is our entire lives.
At least 400 British citizens have been targeted by foreign regimes using Pegasus, yet Number 10 has remained stunningly silent on the matter.
How on earth could Great Britain, no less, be blasé regarding 400 of its citizens being attacked in such a callous, obscene, despicable manner by a regime that is non-democratic, absolutely, it's anti-democratic, authoritarian, rogue, corrupt regime such as the United Arab Emirates?
The UAE have failed to respond to the accusations, but they are ultimately just one of up to 40 regimes currently using the Pegasus service. The real question for British victims is, did local intelligence services know about the hacking? And if not, how could this failure have possibly been allowed to occur? Robert Carter, London.
The
U.S. Deputy Secretary of State Wendy Sherman visited Seoul this week to meet with her South Korean counterparts to discuss North Korea, China, and other issues. She stressed what she sees as the two states' mutual concerns in remarks also aimed at Beijing.
Our two countries are bound together by our common security interests, by our economic ties, by our common values of democracy and freedom. We will continue to discuss regional challenges, including actions that run counter to the interests of the United States and the Republic of Korea and threaten to undermine the rules-based international orders.
South Korea has tried to balance its relations between China, now its largest trading partner, and the U.S., its security guarantor. And Seoul recognizes it needs the U.S. if it wants progress on peace with North Korea. U.S. Deputy Secretary of State Wendy Sherman once again voiced Washington's desire to bring North Korea to the negotiating table and its support for inter-Korean engagement, issues of primary importance to South Korean President Moon Jae-in. But Washington's support on those issues may come with strings attached, as the U.S. seeks its Asian allies' backing in its ongoing crisis with China. Joining the U.S. containment strategy against China might be costly for South Korea, say experts. Large demonstrations against the deployment of the American anti-missile defense system, THAAD, erupted when it was deployed in 2017. China then slapped South Korea with heavy economic sanctions over hosting the U.S. missile Shield.
It's a tragic history that powerful countries have used the Korean Peninsula as their battlefield. Preventing that history from repeating itself is most important for South Korea to avoid becoming entangled in a battle between the U.S. and China. It must firmly stake out a neutral position, even though it would cause friction with the U.S.
Sherman will next visit Mongolia and then China for just the second high-level meeting between American and Chinese officials since U.S. President Joe Biden took office. Frank Smith, Seoul.
Environment and energy ministers from the group of 20 rich nations have gathered in Italy's southern city of Naples for a two-day summit on environment, energy and climate change. The talks, chaired by Italy, which holds the rotating annual presidency of the G20, have reportedly been inconclusive so far, as officials are struggling to find common ground to put together joint statements on the topics being discussed. On Thursday, Naples saw a number of anti-G20 protests being staged in different parts of the city. In the morning, hundreds of protesters tried to break into the building where the meeting was taking place. Activists from the campaign group Avaaz, wearing masks depicting Argentinian soccer player Diego Armando Maradona, staged a protest calling for debt relief for developing countries.
People are sick and tired of being lied to. Once again, it looks like there will be a complete lack of any commitments and money. The richest countries are telling the poorest countries we need to protect the environment, and the poorest countries are saying we need money for that.
The largest anti-G20 rally was held on Thursday afternoon in the historic center of Naples. Thousands of people from all walks of life shouted slogans against corporate greed and the influence of governments, and in support of a counter G20 summit. Speaking at the G20 ministerial meeting, Italian Ecological Transition Minister Roberto Cingolani said everyone wants to be green without making the necessary sacrifices. The minister added that if the financial system won't change in favor of sustainable development, there will be catastrophic consequences for future generations.
The Naples G20 meeting is seen as a key intermediate stage ahead of global climate talks known as COP26, UN Climate Change Conference. The meeting is to be held in Glasgow, UK, in November. Max Civili, Rome.
The long-awaited Olympic Games officially kicked off in Tokyo on Friday after a one-year postponement due to the coronavirus pandemic. The opening ceremony took place with no spectators in attendance and a reduced number of athletes joining the parade. Only fewer than 1,000 VIPs and officials were present at the Tokyo's National Stadium. The International Olympic Committee has banned foreign and domestic spectators for the first time in the history of the Olympic Games. Meanwhile, athletes, support staff and media are subject to strict COVID-19 protocols. Most world leaders decided not to participate in the event. Also, top sponsors have stayed away, highlighting strong opposition to holding the event in COVID-fatigued Japan. Tokyo is battling a surge in coronavirus infections and is under emergency measures. Daily cases in Tokyo are currently at their highest in 6 months. The Japanese capital logged nearly 2,000 new daily infections before the official opening ceremony. Japanese officials have vowed to hold safe and secure games despite the lingering pandemic. However, a largely unvaccinated Japanese public is worried that the global gathering of 11,000 athletes could trigger a super spreader event. Earlier this week, the chief of the Tokyo 2020 Organizing Committee said they are not ruling out canceling the games as more athletes pulled out after testing positive for COVID-19. So far, over 100 people linked to the games have tested positive for the virus. A survey by the Asahi Shimbun newspaper says around 70% of Japanese people believe that Olympic organizers are not able to contain coronavirus infections. For weeks, there have been calls for the already postponed games to be cancelled amid the rise of COVID-19 cases in Tokyo and elsewhere across the world. Hundreds of people gathered outside Tokyo's National Stadium ahead of the Olympic opening ceremony, while others demonstrated near the Tokyo government building to demand the cancellation of the event. However, the International Olympic Committee has rejected the idea of calling off the event. The committee could lose billions of dollars in broadcast rights if the games were cancelled. That could be a blatant example of choosing money over people's lives.
Every day, Inas gets on this boat with her younger siblings to help their family with herding their water buffaloes. To them, it's an everyday hobby to play with what they call black monsters, a hobby that is about to turn to ashes. Their bulky playmates are now dying of thirst in an unprecedented drought that has devastated the buffalo's habitat.
Every day we lose two or three of our buffaloes and sheep because there is no water, and this water over there is sour and polluted and is toxic to the animals.
This has been the case for thousands of residents in Iran's province of Khuzestan, who have for the past days been protesting over what they call mismanagement of water resources. Khuzestan is inhabited predominantly by Iranian Arab tribes who live on agriculture and animal farming, which have now been devastated by the worst drought in half a century. Heads of tribes have over the past days been acting as mediators between the protesters and authorities, asking the demonstrators to calm down while urging officials to solve the problems.
We lost our farms and livestock in the drought. We need our rivers and marshlands to be filled with water for our businesses to be up and running again.
Every day the scale of the disaster grows and we are paying the price. Our demand is legitimate. The authorities need to do something before an irreversible catastrophe takes place.
On Friday, leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, stepped in and called on authorities to speed up their efforts to tackle the crisis. Over the past week, delegations from the government and other entities have been visiting the affected areas to review the situation. In one of its latest measures, the government opened the valves of Karkhe and Dez dams, which have partly filled the riverbeds.
Water is starting to trickle into the riverbeds, raising hopes that life will once again return to the dried land. However, residents here say the crisis is far from over, and authorities need to find a permanent solution to the issue. Yusuf Jalali from the outskirts of Bostan in the province of Khuzestan.
I'm Mark Wadsworth. You might have heard
Mark Wadsworth is a lifelong anti-racist who came to prominence during the brutal racist murder
of black teenager Stephen Lawrence in 1993. Mark supported Stephen's parents in their long fight for justice and even introduced them to anti-apartheid revolutionary figures Bishop Desmond Tutu and Nelson Mandela. Yet despite Wadsworth's anti-racial credentials, even he was not spared from the anti-Semitism witch hunt against Jeremy Corbyn's allies and pro-Palestinian activists in the Labour Party.
I couldn't believe that somebody, you know, groups of people would try to fabricate him or character assassinate him with all his contributions.
Mark has done so much for the black community, and he has the black community backing him all the way, and to see such libelous statements being made about him it's very disappointing.
Mark Wadsworth was one of many left-wing pro-Palestinian activists expelled from the Labour Party during Jeremy Corbyn's leadership following an unfounded accusation of anti-Semitism. Since then, he's been smeared by a host of British tabloids, including the Jewish Chronicle, who today have been obliged to apologise in open court as well as pay substantial damages. The Jewish Chronicle also published an apology to Mark back in May for an article published in March that accused him of conspiracy to, quote, intimidate, threaten or harass Jewish activists. Accusations that they have now admitted were wholly false.
I'm elated. I've been vindicated. I've suffered 5 years of smear, trial by media. In fact, with the Jewish Chronicle, I managed to get them to change 15 stories. Over a period of less than 5 years, they have had almost 50 articles naming me in a negative way, which is like a vendetta. And I just decided this has got to stop. It's the Labour Party that has done this to me, because by kicking me out on totally false grounds, huge miscarriage of justice, in April 2018, they made it open season.
The judge in the British High Court described accuracy and truth as fundamental tenets of journalism and explained that the allegations made by the Jewish Chronicle with regards to Mark Wadsworth fell short of both. The lies told by the Chronicle were one of many by British tabloid press, but Wadsworth hopes his legal victory will act as a deterrent for those that seek to smear him in the future. Ahmed Cabello, London.
Let the bodies pile on high in their thousands. A sentence seared into the memories of Britons, allegedly uttered by the British Prime Minister Boris Johnson as he reluctantly approved a second England-wide lockdown late last year. Faced with fury from relatives of the bereaved, Johnson and his senior ministers emphatically denied the allegation. The man who made that claim, his former top aide turned nemesis, Dominic Cummings, back with more.
This is terrible, but the people who are dying are essentially all over 80. And we can't kill the economy just because of people dying over 80.
Speaking to the British public broadcaster, he also questioned his former boss's fitness for his role and rebuked the government's pandemic performance. Just like that time, the government denies the allegations, saying the Prime Minister has taken the necessary action to protect lives and livelihoods, guided by the best scientific advice. But the numbers speak otherwise. England had one of the worst per capita deaths among the world's major economies last year, blamed by many on lockdown dithering by the government.
It was even more than that. It was an ideological predisposition towards laissez-faire capitalism and not caring about the fate of the poor. And that's deeply entrenched. They thought, let it spread through the population. Yes, the old will die, but they could use that crisis actually to generate pressure to further pursue the policies they're pursuing anyway, which are not protecting the NHS.
The new allegations come only days after Number 10 made England the first country to lift almost all COVID-related restrictions, despite the rising number of cases, mostly of the Delta variant.
If you look at this Tory cabinet, they look like people who are totally unfitted for office because they simply don't care about the lives and quality of lives of the vast majority of the working people of Britain. That's not their remit. They are there to protect big business. They've shown that time and again. The fact of Cummings and Johnson falling out is just once again shedding light on what they would really like to bury, and no doubt they will try and bury when they're forced to have a COVID inquiry.
A public inquiry into the government's pandemic response is yet to happen, and it remains to be seen if these latest revelations from the Prime Minister's former advisor will seriously puncture his opinion poll rates or lead to pressure from members of his own party for him to step down. Saeed Forizam, London.
For thousands of years, the Nile River has meant life to people in a largely arid region. But today, the river is associated with an endless dispute. Ethiopia said on Monday that it had attained its second-year target for filling a mega dam on the Blue Nile, the Nile River's main tributary. The country said the plant may start generating power in the next few months.
We are now putting the turbines of what we call Unit 10. As soon as some important works are completed in a few months, it's all about connecting it to the transformers. And this will provide the biggest outcome of this work for the people of Ethiopia, which is generating electric power.
The project, called the Grand Ethiopian Renaissance Dam, has been at the center of a regional dispute since Ethiopia broke ground on the project in 2011. Egypt, a dry land home to nearly 100 million people, depends on the Nile for 97% of its water supply. And Sudan views the dam as a threat to its own dams and water stations, but Ethiopia deems the project essential for its development. A decade of negotiations under the auspices of the African Union has failed to result in a deal on the dam's filling and operations. The UN Security Council met earlier this month to discuss the project, but Ethiopia later slammed the session as an unhelpful distraction from the AU-led process. Experts say foreign powers' intervention throughout the years has only aggravated tensions in the region and that an African approach to the problem is needed.
I think the problem is the intervention of the imperialist countries, particularly the United States at this stage. So what has to happen is a more pan-African approach to this problem. Sudan and Egypt should sit down with Ethiopia and negotiate a policy which will benefit all three countries.
Once completed, the $4 billion project will produce more than 5,000 megawatts of electricity, doubling Ethiopia's power output. This is significant for an economy that frequently faces electricity shortages and is sometimes hobbled by power rationing. But Egypt considers the dam as a threat to its existence, and Sudan has warned that millions of lives will be at great risk if Ethiopia unilaterally fills the dam. Is a war between Egypt, Sudan, and Ethiopia brewing on the Nile? The next few months might show if tensions explode into yet another hot conflict in the war-stricken continent.
The cleanup operation continues in Belgium and Germany, the countries worst affected by last week's devastating floods following torrential rainfall. Senior figures from the European Commission have just attended a meeting of EU environment ministers.
50 degrees northwest Canada, 40 degrees in Siberia, 40 degrees in Central Europe. The floods you've mentioned, droughts agriculture is dealing with, wildfires.
Last week, the European Commission unveiled plans to cut greenhouse gas emissions in the 27-nation bloc by 55% over the next 9 years. The Commission claims it's a matter of life and death.
The infernos and hurricanes we have seen over the last few weeks are only a very small window into what our future could look like.
Environmentalists point to what's happening right now. Raging wildfires in parts of the United States and Canada, severe flooding in regions of China, crippling droughts in areas of Iran, recent tornadoes in the Czech Republic. In order to save the planet, campaigners insist the EU must cooperate with big powers like Russia, China and Iran instead of pushing them away. Official data shows transport accounts for 29% of pollution in the EU, but one large ship generates as much carbon dioxide per day as 80,000 cars. Of course, the aviation industry is another major player, and so too is agriculture. Experts say the key is to cut our